Well, Will Vincent, thanks for showing up. You're on Django Chat with Carlton Gibson, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And you were on the board for a while, the treasurer of Django, the Django Foundation. Is that right?
Yep. The Django Software Foundation, which is the nonprofit that runs Django.
Okay. And one of the cool things that I think is neat that you did was while you were there, I think you were involved or did the merchandise store.
So I pushed over the line. So there was lots of efforts over the years to have official merchandise, and with all things with volunteers, because the board is a volunteer position, it just takes a final push. So you can go now, it's on Threadless, and buy swag. Not a ton of people do, but it makes some money for Django. All the profits go to Django. And during COVID, the conferences were virtual and they were able to put up their swag on there. So that was a good community building thing.
Wow, you can even get the Django Con Australia t-shirt.
Yeah, so that's perfect example. So Django Con or PyCon Australia, which has a Django track, is happening right now. So they put it up for anyone who's attending online and wants to have swag. So, you know, I look at it and we could do a lot of things that are better, but it exists and it's there. And, you know, you go to a Django Con conference, which I suggest to everyone should do if they can. And there's like swag from almost everyone but Django, because Django, even though it has a huge reach, is ultimately a nonprofit. It's a nonprofit with an annual budget of less than like a West Coast developer makes. So though it feels big, it's quite small, and it's all run by volunteers. So there's three paid people. There's two fellows, and then there's a woman, Catherine Holmes, who assists the board part-time. So that's it. That's the entire cost of Django.
Yeah. But even just like a green t-shirt with Django on it, it's neat. I like it.
Yeah, well, I think I was inspired actually partly by your co-host, Michael Kennedy. He had some swag and I asked him about it. And so that got the ball rolling. And then when I applied to run for the board four years ago, I guess, that was one of the things I asked around, and everyone said, oh, we've talked about it, but we didn't quite have it. So I definitely joined the board and hit the ground running, being like, I wanted to do a bunch of things, and one of those was the merchandise.
Yeah, I was thinking, I think it'd be cool if Python did that too, because there's Django and Python conferences going on all over the world. I think it'd be fun. I don't know. I'm kind of one of the kind of dorks that would totally buy a conference t-shirt that I didn't go to, just because they're neat. Sometimes they're neat. The Python, the one that happens in New York.
Gotham. Hi, Gotham.
Yeah, they often have really great t-shirts. And I'm like, man, I wish I could get one of those. That'd be cool. So,
yeah, well, it's interesting when you get on the inside. So these are all volunteer positions. I suggest everyone get involved because you just get to meet the people. And one of the things is the Python Software Foundation. They have a new executive director, but through working through Django, had conversations with them because there's overlap around grants and legal things. And I was always surprised they don't have more of a push on merchandise, but you know, they're growing in staff, but they're still small. I think they're still 12, 15 full-time people in different roles. So, you know, there's always, you know, just like open source, if you see something and you want to change it, you know, raise a hand and make it happen.
Well, can I volunteer somebody else? No.
Well, so this is, you know, and this is, especially with Django. So Django, I've had this discussion. So I stepped away from the board this year because I did 3 years, and I think it's good to have new blood. You know, there's constantly people have ideas for things that Django should do, but ultimately it's seven board members who on paper meet once 1 hour a month, and that's it. Okay. In practice, the president and the treasurer in particular do a lot more work than that, but it's not really sustainable. And, you know, so I'm kind of at the point where, and again, we had a whole track at DjangoCon Europe in Edinburgh this year about this. People say, well, why doesn't Django do X, Y, Z? It's just not going to happen unless we have an executive director and or raise more money. And we're not going to raise more money until we know where it's going to go. And we're not going to know where it's going to go until, the community agrees on doing it. So this is sort of the tyranny of a democracy, is that, you know, sometimes it'd be nice to just have one person in charge who could make things happen, or have a paid executive director who can do these things, prioritize the list and actually make them happen. Because, you know, we all have other jobs. So,
okay. Speaking of other jobs, so you also wrote, you wrote some books, right? About Django.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have three books on Django, Django for Beginners, APIs and Professionals, that we were discussing before we started recording. They first came out in 2018, and I've updated them all at least five times because Django updates every 8 months. So in a way, I've done, 15 updates, versions of the books. But on the other hand, you could look at it and say, I haven't written a new book in 4 years. so those are the primary ways I make my money these days. I do some consulting and mentoring, but I've been able to make the books work. I also have run a Django newsletter. We didn't mention Django News. It's a weekly newsletter I run with Jeff Triplett, because going on, I think, 3 years now, because Django itself doesn't have a newsletter and there's plenty going on. So that's a weekly newsletter with projects, news, articles, packages, just because no one was doing it. And Jeff Triplett he's a partner at RevSys, which is one of the preeminent Django consultancies. And he's also been on the PSF. I forget his title, but he's a director. So he's as high as you can get. So he and I do that together for the community.
Hmm. Yeah. Plus just a really swell guy.
Exactly. Yeah. And he also he's still involved, but he's helped been on DEFNA, which is the Django Events Foundation of North America, which runs DjangoCon US. So, you know, it's good to just get involved and find out who people are, because it's just people and usually volunteers making things happen. And Django in particular is all about the community. You can't really see from the website what an amazing community it has, but it has an incredible community. I mean, you know, and just not to take a pot shot, but in comparison to Flask, Flask is an amazing tool and David Lord does great work. Flask does not have a community like Django, right? Django has a board, Django has conferences, Django has podcasts, meetups, you know, different tools for different things. But it's one of the marketing challenges, I think, in a way of Django compared to other web frameworks, is that how do you communicate the community? Because the saying is, come for the framework, you know, stay for the community.
Well, I was just talking with Carlton, and he had a great quote. He said, the Django community is the home he'd been missing before he found it. And he said, like, for instance, he would not have done 5 years of being a fellow if it wasn't for the community being so wonderful. So, and I feel that about it, the Python community as a whole. I don't think I would be such an advocate for Python if it wasn't for the community being so awesome. So,
And it's just all about telling people that and then having opportunities for them to get the first experience of it. So, you know, conferences are a great way. You know, it's been hard post COVID. A lot of meetups have gone away, but people, you know, you hear it, but you need to experience it. You need a touch point.
So, I'm looking at learnjango.com on a separate window.
Yes.
Is that the great best place for people to find your books?
Yeah, that's the best place. So I'm in a bit of a transition of, I have physical books on Amazon. I also have them through Gumroad, and I'm working towards having everything just on learnjango.com. So learnjango.com has a whole ton of free tutorials. You can get the books, and I'm moving towards a model of having everything just online for a number of reasons. One of which is accessibility, actually. You know, people all over the world want to learn Django and Python. And how do you translate it, right? Like, I get offers to translate my books, but given the pace of updates, it just doesn't work to go through, you know, to update it in all the different languages. But if you use all the major browsers have pretty solid translation built in. So if it's in HTML, someone can translate it into Japanese, Chinese, whatever language, and get, you know, kind of 80, 90% of the way there.
Huh.
And it's maintainable for me. Whereas doing, you know, I would love to have Brazilian, German, French, Russian, whatever translations of my books, and I get offers for it, but it doesn't make sense given the amount of sales and given the update pattern.
So if I buy, buy one of your eBooks, I can view it through the browser then?
Not yet.
Okay.
So if you buy the eBooks, you get a PDF or an EPUB through Gumroad.
Okay.
So the plan is to have it just all seamlessly on one site. Right now I've got a whole constellation of sites. Like, there's different sites for the book. So you can read the first like quarter of all three books on their dedicated sites.
Okay. Well, so I have some more. So you've got three books, Django for Beginners, Django for APIs, and Django for Professionals. which one sells the most?
Beginners.
But
it's not crazy. I mean, beginners is probably like 40%, and then maybe like 30 for the other two.
Okay. Now, do they build on each other? So if, can I read?
They do. So this is the thing that I wrote them boom, 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 4 or 5 years ago initially. And now with the updates, that is the question, like, which one do I do first? They progress. They do progress on each other. There is a tiny bit of overlap with the APIs book. So, which comes first? Like, should, after beginners, do you do the APIs or do professionals? Professionals guides you through Docker and production level deployments and all the other kind of full goodies that Django provides. It doesn't go into APIs, even though most Django developers will be writing APIs for a front end.
Okay.
So I don't have a perfect answer. I usually say, depends what you need at work. If it's just you and you just want to like get a site up, or you're a small team, the professionals, but the APIs one is written, for Django REST framework and APIs, because there wasn't any book that I was aware of at the time. And there's still very few that kind of show you how to do authentication, how to do security, how to deploy. All the first two books definitely started off as my own notes to myself on how to do all this as I was learning.
Okay.
And then I had a break in employment. I joined a company that then was sold and was not asked to continue on. So while I was interviewing, I decided to publish these books, and that led me on the path I am today.
And I'm actually amazed that you make a living, like full-time living off of writing.
Yeah, everyone is, which I'm always like not sure how to respond to that. But it's a couple things. I mean, one is that before I learned how to program, I started my career as a book editor, which is probably unusual. Editing trade fiction, nonfiction, all that kind of stuff for 5 years. Huh. And then I got, and then I learned how to code and got an MBA. And then I worked at startups in San Francisco. I was the third employee at a place called Quizlet, which is an educational.
I remember Quizlet. Flashcard. Yeah.
Flashcard place. Yeah. So there was, employee number three. It's supposed to IPO at some point. That would be nice. And so I had that experience. And, what I took away from that is, so I'd never lived on the West Coast before. But there's such a divide, obviously, between people who can code and people who can't. And I remember thinking, I'm young enough, I've got a brain. This is the, like, I helped hire the entire technical team, the first 10 developers there. But the one thing I couldn't do was like code.
Okay.
I had learned how to code and build basic websites while I was actually transitioning out of publishing. So I had a small business building websites for book authors, because that would be a couple thousand dollars and we'd hire people to do it. And I was like, oh, I could do that. So I learned how to do that, not award-winning, but good enough. And did that for a number of authors. And then I wanted to make the transition to the West Coast. So I came into all this later in life.
Oh, wow.
Which I think informs my perspective in a couple of ways, because I'm not formally trained. And I'm also not as malleable in terms of, I still get upset at how hard it is to learn how to code. I still think coding itself is generally not that complicated. It's just poorly taught. And it's poorly taught because most people learned it when they were like 12, or they learned it in an engineering course. And, so they think that's how it should be taught. And I think that is how it should be taught if you're getting an engineering degree bottoms up. But if you're just trying to learn on your own and get a job and be functional, much more of a mixing of context and theory is relevant. And so certainly my beginner's book, there's a lot of like, we're just going to build this thing and then I'll backfill. I will cover the information, but I'm not going to like barrage you with fundamentals up front. I want you to get that aha of things working. Huh. And then I will show how it all fits together. But the irony is, over the years, as I've been doing all this for well over a decade now, I find that the small things interesting. So I've become kind of what I didn't want to be. I've become one of those like engineering professor people. Like now I'm like excited by the details. And so every edition I put more and more in there, but I try really hard to make clear, like it's sort of like as an aside, like, this is how password stuff is actually working. Like you don't need to know that, but I want you to know that it's there for when you're ready for it or you have the inkling.
Yeah.
But somebody who can kind of say, here's the main course and there's all these side quests. But when you're starting out, you don't have anyone to sort of tell you. I mean, I see this when I mentor people. There's how do you there's no way to separate what I should do, what I shouldn't do. Like, you can spend days, weeks on something, and someone's experience is like, oh, that doesn't really matter.
Well, one of the frustrating things I have is how hard it is to write and self-publish an ebook in still today. I'm curious, like, okay, so you sell through Gumroad, Amazon, and on your site, where does most of the traffic come from? Is it?
The traffic comes from me because I have a whole lot of free tutorials.
Okay.
And then I have the free first like 3 or 4 chapters of all the books available. So it's very much like, you know, try it, like see what you like. So the progression generally is people find a tutorial and then from there they find the book and then I give away quite a lot of it. And, you know, if they like my teaching style, then they'll fill it in. So it's all... I've been doing this long enough. I'm at a point where I want to keep creating content, but I need to focus a little more on the marketing side and think about how to do that. Because most, you know, as you can attest, most people who write a book have a full-time job and, you know, it's something they focus on, but it's not necessarily the full focus, but you can get kind of wrapped up in like, I need to make my content better and you should, but how do you, it's like anything, you know, if you believe enough to create the product, you should believe enough to sell the product. And so I've been thinking a lot. Especially this summer, I've been stepping a little bit away from the keyboard, trying to think about like, okay, how do I, you know, is this what I'm going to do the next 7 years? Like, how do I make this work? And so, yeah, so, you know, actually you were just telling me like, you know, videos is one thing, right? Like you just, you're thinking about videos. I'm thinking about videos, but you know, time is limited. So as a content creator, you have to balance learning, creating, and marketing.
Yeah. So like, for instance, I don't even have a way for people to find the video. So I've started doing the PyTest book as a course, as 3 courses, actually. And by the time I air this episode, it will be at pythontest.com/course or courses or one of those things. There'll be a page that talks about it. Right now, all it has is I did a course for Michael on his Talk Python. So there's a little short course there. But I had fun doing it. So I'm really enjoying doing the course because, especially with working with an editor, and I think that the pragmatic editors really did help make the PyTest book better. But you have, you know, multiple like 5 versions of this stuff or 3 versions at least, or 5, did you say 5 versions of each book?
I think I'm on the 5th update.
That's amazing.
I think it was like, I mean, it's, you know, but I think, is it where I need to most spend my time? Because every update, I'm thinking about, so 5.0 for Django comes out in December. If there's a way to have just like a 5.0 release or 5.x release that covers for 2.5 years, because the reality is 99% of it is like Django does a really good job of being mature and not breaking things.
Yeah.
And for me as a creator, it's just such a burden. It's not even the code. It's just all the logistics of updating the text and then updating the books and then updating the websites and updating the GitHub repo. And all that takes up a lot of time that could be spent on new courses or new things when, you know, the code is fine. But, you know, again, from the outside, you look in, you say, oh, it was 4.2 and it's 5.0. That seems a lot different. And it's like, well, it's pretty much the same. but the problem is that the 5% that's different is the 5% that if you're new to this will like full stop you.
Well, since you're doing like the marketing side for it, one of the things I would suggest that I plan on doing with the marketing of the PyTest book is just letting people know that it still works. Like test it and make sure that and maybe update the site and say, yeah, it still says in the book 4.2, but it works fine on whatever the current version is or something.
My experience is I've said that and done that and people still like, kind of want to see the shiny new number, which I understand. I mean, I think it depends. Yeah. The interesting thing for me about video, I mean, because you know, PyTest, I guess, is a little more advanced maybe than some other things because you have to know Python, you have to have some sense of testing. I've always thought of video as being certainly designed for true beginners who get fully stuck. I'm curious, you know, how you do and how the market is for more advanced video courses. I mean, on the one hand, you see people like Wes Boss and Kenzie Dodds and some of these in the JavaScript realm who charge like premium prices. But I don't see most people seem to just go to like Udemy and get, you know, a $9 whatever course. I'm curious how how big the upper end of that sphere is.
Well, we'll see. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we'll see.
Instance, I'm working on chapter 3, which is the biggie for PyTest, which is fixtures. PyTest is really pretty easy to work with, but it's a mind shift, and fixtures are definitely one of the mind shift things. So I'm really enjoying, between the first edition and the second edition of the book, I completely revamped how I teach fixtures. And I go a lot slower. However, I'm going even more slow in the course, the video course, but I can also do it different. So I start with some visual slides with drawings and stuff and say, this is, you know, I can move boxes around and stuff and say, oh, this, the setups over here and teardowns over here. I do more drawings and artwork and then do a demo and then go back to, and then I'm going to redo the demo and say, okay, let's do it again, but do it slightly different just because you got to have that repetition. But the cool thing about the video is somebody can watch it and then go all through all three of these models at like 1.25 speed or something and see the whole thing in like 10 minutes. And then they go, I still don't get it. They can watch it again.
Well, it's more how you would do it if you were sitting next to someone
with
the video. I mean, because when you write a book, you kind of have to predict what's going to be confusing and address it.
Yeah.
But you're just kind of guessing. Ultimately it's like a recipe book, right? It's just like, this, and you have to somehow make it readable and somehow be like, and you're probably going to think this, but really it's that. So for me, is when I'm writing stuff, I'm always trying to think about where is that line? Because my email is very available. I email every day with readers. So I have some sense of, you know, what's tricky, but I figure out where to put that line. You kind of have to guess. Whereas if it's just a video, I think it does open up ways to be a little more, it's just more visuals, you know, other ways to show stuff.
Yeah. And like, say chapter 2 was maybe just one chapter, but there's probably 15 or 16 videos in it. So, and they're only like a few minutes each, but, I'm enjoying that granularity. So in the future, if there's things that break on a new PyTest, I can maybe just update that section and not all of it. Sort of things like that.
So, that's the sort of the problem is always upgrades.
Yeah.
with everything. I mean, even I forget his last name, but Anthony, who runs there's a YouTube channel, Pretty Printed, and he's done a number of Django courses. And he's stopping doing courses just because it's too much for him to do the updates. And I see this happen again and again and again. And I certainly feel the pain. And that's in some ways that's what I most worry about with video, because unless, you know, can you just go in and snip and just change just a couple things that are different, or do you have to redo the whole thing? Because, you know, with text, you can just jump in and do it.
We'll see. I don't know. I'm having fun it though. Is Learn Django, is the site a Django site?
So it is a Django site. My personal website, WS Vincent, is it's still, what is it? It's Jekyll. So it's Ruby, and it's something I set up a long time ago, a static site, and I just can't be bothered to change it. But Learn Django is actually a Django site. So I'm sort of excited about having a personal site that I can just do. I can just make it perfect in a way that you never could in a professional setting. Like if I want to have 100% test coverage, I can.
Yeah.
If I want to do all these over optimizations and stuff, I think it's important to have one project at least like that. That's a playground, but with users, because for me, I have so many tutorials and books, and it's generally relatively simple toy projects that I'm creating.
Yeah.
So it just, sometimes that's a little less satisfying than like taking a week and just being like, I'm just going to do like, you know, real in quotes Django now and, you know, do all the stuff that I want to do that I know, you know, in a professional setting, you don't have the flexibility to do it. But if I find something interesting or challenging, I know that others will too. And so that leads me to a course.
Yeah.
So I'd love to, like, I mean, if you Google right now Django testing tutorial, I'm pretty sure it's something I wrote, which I would love to do a testing course, but I don't know if there's a market for there. But you know, once I fully add I've sketched it out once I fully, you know, I'm like, well, one thing I could do is really get to 100% coverage and all these cool things I want to do with PyTest and the rest, and then, you know, turn it into a course. So trying to get that flywheel of like learning, coding, teaching.
Well, I think that would be cool. And I know of at least one platform you could sell on. And anyway, so the PyTest course I'm working on is under a test and code banner. And I think I would have no problem with bringing on other people to, if you wanted.
Okay, cool. Open. Well, that's always the, you know, this is the progression, right? It's sort of like the progression of like, you see a YouTube channel, someone starts with a niche, like coding, and then they end up doing like personal productivity hacks. They go like more general. That's like what people actually want to see. Like, yeah. I find that you, yeah, like it's hard once you've done the marketing to create, you know, the testing thing or the Python thing, right? Like Michael Kennedy has, or the Django thing, then it's like, oh, well, why don't I just bring in other content? And that makes sense. But I also see that then you're spending, as the maintainer of that, then you're spending a lot of time like editing other people's stuff rather than doing your own stuff.
Oh, and yeah. It's a question,
of size.
Yeah, never mind.
No, I'm not saying you shouldn't. I don't know if you can tell. I overthink everything. But I've seen like my friend Michael Herman, who runs testdriven.io, he was one of the creators of realpython.com. And they spent a lot of time doing this. And he had frustrations around updates. And that's one of the reasons he sold it to Dan Bader. And then he and I worked on the early versions of testdriven.io, which is a Django site together. And now he's kind of recreated it in a good way, but it's just, I sort of know that devil a little bit, in terms of,
so I,
not a Django discussion.
I know what you mean about the having a website that you can work on. I've got a side project that's Django that I've going really slowly because of all the other stuff I'm doing, but I'm looking forward to having that be the playground where I can figure out testing in Django and deployment and all that sort of stuff. And then also just make it something I want to, that I'm proud of. It's completely not targeted to programmers, so I'm not even going to plug it here because nobody's going to need it. But it's sort of fun as far as, like my personal site, it's in Hugo, but really, really it's in Markdown.
Exactly.
I don't touch anything with Hugo other than I like configure some YAML files and I write in Markdown and that's it. So,
my Jekyll site's in Markdown. I mean, my Django, learn Django, I write in Markdown, you know, in terms of writing.
So how about your books? Did you do your own custom pipeline or do you use like some other pipeline to generate?
No, books. I do it manual. I'm kind of old school because I know people have created test suites and stuff for their things. I've found that I like just 8 months have passed going through it all from scratch. And I have to kind of do it anyways, cause I create a whole new, I don't trust the code enough to do it. Like it's not just that fixing things that break. It's also, do I want to, it's like the subjective things around style, cause that changes over time. So I go through them all from scratch and do it all from scratch each time.
You're manually writing the EPUB document?
Oh no, sorry. To generate that, I use LeanPub.
Oh, okay.
I use LeanPub to generate it.
All right.
But in terms of like the text itself and the code itself, I go through all that manually.
Yeah. Oh,
some people write a little script and then use that to kind of update their additions for the code.
Oh, right. Yeah. I'm not sure how I would do it now. I did market a little LeanPub based book on testing a long time ago. So I'm familiar with at least what LeanPub was 10 years ago.
I don't know what it's like. This is the problem with getting older. You're like, why does things change? You know, so like LeanPub, I started with it. They had like a 95% or 90% royalty rate and great tools. And then they switched it to 80%. And then Gumroad came along and Gumroad was like 97%. Like, that's great. But now Gumroad is now 90%. You know, so if you're locked into a platform, they're going to put the squeeze on you eventually. Yeah. but it's, you know, so like I've thought about, like, I've worked to have like a more professional cover, for my covers because I design the covers, you know, so they're not amazing. And it's an issue that people think the books are not as good as they are because the cover is not great. So I'd like to design a cover. So I have to get someone to do the cover, and that and that's a whole process and hundreds of dollars. And then I need to update it for each edition, I think, right? So that's an update. And then what if I change the amount of text? Now the spine changes. Now I have to change that.
Oh, geez.
And then I have to change the interior layout. So it's, you know, there's a reason why publishing houses, it's not just time. It's ultimately a couple thousand dollars per update,
yeah,
just to do one update for one book. And I'm thinking about, I still want to have at least one in-print book, but it may be the case that I move to online stuff and just have like one textbooky. I mean, so the Django for Beginners book is used, I mean, I know in a number of universities as like a semester long web course right now. So it'd be nice to sort of maybe have that be, if you want like a physical book, you can have that. But it's just all the other maintenance stuff is difficult to do with a web framework that updates so often, right? Like Python and PyTest. Yeah, they change, but people don't see them changing as much.
Well, and they're very actually, and PyTest has been almost as good at Python actually about maintaining backwards compatibility. Like you can kind of ignore the new features if you want to for a long time.
I mean, Django too. It's more that the web space changes. I have a curious question for you. I mean, because I know you were, you know, I think sometimes people think that web stuff or Django stuff is like a novice thing, but like I know from experience that there's many people who've been coding Python for 10, 20 years or more, but haven't touched web, who then, you know, will say nice things about my books because the other books assume a whole breadth of web knowledge that you may not know, even if you've been doing a programmer. So that's one thing I get a little frustrated with is that people kind of assuming the web stuff is simple if they're coming from other realms, when the reality is like, yeah, I get lots of emails from people who doing stuff for decades and, you know, having trouble.
Well, one of the things that's difficult as a teacher, or like a course creator or a book writer or something is to pick a target audience. Like for me, I'm new to Django, but, man, I started learning. I learned web stuff in the 90s when it was like when there was one browser you could do. We had Netscape Navigator, and that was it.
Right. Right.
And then I started writing like raw HTML with image files and Perl CGI scripts in the back end. Then I left for a while, did embedded stuff, and then when I came back to build something. Learned a little PHP, then learned a little WordPress, then came back later and then learned some JavaScript and some CSS. And then even then, when I came back again, CSS is completely different. CSS is a programming language.
Yeah, Tailwind and everything.
Yeah, it's got compilers SAS, and everything.
Yeah.
And
yep.
It's mind-boggling. So trying to find a Django tutorial that is like, I'm new to Django, but I get the web already. It's been difficult, to try to, and also I'm a really impatient person. I can't remember who I was talking to, but I'm great for like, I understand the beginner mindset thing and I'm totally fine with walking through like a toy tutorial or something. And I like toy tutorials for learning new things. But then after I've done that, I'm like, okay, now I want to draw the rest of the owl. Now I want to build like a professional website with e-commerce in it and slideshows and all that sort of stuff. And it's hard to get from beginner to something that looks polished. So
yeah. I've thought about this in terms of maybe there's something, you know, maybe there's like a recipe book or something like where for someone like you or even someone like me, like I've going through stuff like, so I've talking to people who said like, yeah, I went through your book, but then I was trying to implement it in my own site and I was just getting stuck. And I was like, well, I showed you how to do it all. And they're like, well, but you know, you were teaching while you were doing it. It would have helped to have like a final project that just sort of like, let's just blast through it the way, you know, you would if you knew this, as opposed to like paragraphs of explanation about stuff. that's something that stuck with me that I'm thinking about.
Well, that,
you know, even for me,
that might be great as a video course where you could just say, you're just going to talk while you're building it. Okay. I'm going to build a, like a little stupid bookstore or something. And then walk through all the stuff, and record.
Yeah.
It.
Well,
so,
yeah. So I think there's room for that, for something that's, you know, there is someone, Matt Lehman, who does, he does like weekly podcasts where, or excuse me, video screencasts where he builds Django stuff. He does great content. Yeah. I think to me, the issue is like, I'm impatient. I like things curated. Like, I don't want to see someone like pull their hair out and like hunt around for a bug. I would rather see someone just kind of like do it in God mode and just do it as a reference point. But that requires a whole lot more polish than, you know, actually doing it. But I still think there's, you know, that's what I've been thinking about, because I want to do more advanced stuff, but I can't always like explain everything. And I don't, you know, so just say like, hey, I've got beginner stuff. Like, we're just going to kind of fly here. You know, even setting up a new Django site from scratch. Like, so one of the repos I have two kind of popular repos. One is an awesome Django repo with Jeff Triplett, with like curated stuff that got like 7,000 something stars. And then I have a starter project, Django X, which along with, I'm blanking on it, Cookie Cutter Django, I think are two of the more popular starter projects. Because even someone who knows how to use Django, it's like, you just want to like, hey, I just want to like have authentication, simple deployment. I want to build the thing. I don't want to like reinstall Django and go through all the steps.
Yeah.
It still takes so much time, even for me when I teach this stuff. And, you know, professional developers who haven't created a new project in a couple of years, you know, I've had people who are like, you know, who like wrote Django, who like have referred to stuff I've written because they just haven't done it from scratch in a while. So maybe there's like a premium recipe book thing for like, get me to this, you know, get me to the owl, like, and you can skip some step, but like, just show me how to do it.
Well, that might be a cool thing for like a subscription site too, to be able to just say like, you know, if it's low enough that I can forget about the subscription fee, just to have, like when I run into the authentication, I'm like, oh, how do I do that or something? Or
right. Well, because you're ultimately you're time saving, right? I mean, when you get, I think, past intermediate level, it's like, okay, you could figure it out. But like, if someone just gives it to you and saves you a couple hours, what's that worth? Probably worth a lot.
Yeah. And I'm not ready yet to just like ask an AI to write it for me. So
I'm not quite, you know, Simon Willison, I don't know if you've had him on, one of the co-creators of Django. You know, he's kind of at that point, but I've talked with him and others, and I think if you already know how to do it, AI is great because you can spot the 10% that's nonsense.
Yeah.
But as a learning tool, or even if you're intermediate, I don't know, maybe I'm old fashioned, but I think you have to already be a master to appreciate the scaffolding, because you can toss out the nonsense, because it still has nonsense.
Yeah. And also, I mean, Simon Willison's brain moves so fast that,
oh my God, he's frantic.
I think that like an AI bot is the only thing that could keep up with him, like coming up with new ideas.
I think actually, if there was the first place that I would want to see this, would actually be testing in a way. I feel like testing in the web context would be a great place for AI, because you can kind of like, does it work? Does it not work? It's can be relatively simple for unit tests. As I think of the web stack, I feel like, you know, and actually that was one of the talks, I don't know if you saw, there was one of the talks at DjangoCon Europe. I'll pull it up. They were sort of creating automated tests, like kind of on the fly for people, because anyways, I think that's kind of like, if I had to pick an area of Django that AI would influence, it would be the testing suite.
Yeah. Okay. That'd be interesting. A lot of times I get a lot of questions for people ask, like, how do I test this thing or something?
Right.
And my first question back to them is, well, how do you know if it's working or not? Because if you don't know if it's working or not, if you can't describe how it's working or not, then you can't write a test for it. And that often leads to research. So I'm not sure how to tell an AI how to tell if what my intent was, so that it can generate the right test for something.
I'm gonna share with you this talk, because it's only had, so criminal, only 500 views. It's called Turning Test Writing into a Consistently Brief and Pleasant Experience from Django Con Europe 2023. I mean, it's the only talk the entire conference that got a standing ovation.
Okay. Well, I'll have to watch that. That's a great title. I should have subtitled my book that. That's great.
Well, you should. I can introduce you. But part of that, with all this stuff, it's like, how do you convince people that they have a problem? You know, it's like, how do you sell soap? How do you tell people they smell? It's like, how do you tell them that their code is lousy and they need tests? Or how do you tell them that it could be better? Like, it's difficult to do the thing and then to like figure out how to convince people of the thing, right? Like for you, like, how do you, you know, people are like, oh, my code kind of works, you know, web stuff, like, yeah, stakes are low. Like, why do I need PyTests? Like, what's your kind of response to that?
Well, you might not. Does it work already? I mean, like,
it depends. Yeah.
If your customers are griping, and then maybe you ought to test more before they, so that you catch it before your customers do. But a lot of people
can ignore the engineer griping. They don't count. But yeah, the customers.
Well, I think engineering griping is worthwhile listening to as well. I test not because I care about quality, but that's not why I test. I test because being a software engineer is more fun when I can lean on the test to know things are working. So,
right. Well, it's like, how do you trust a coworker, let alone yourself 6 months ago?
Yeah, I don't.
Let alone, so. You know, third party updates. Well, that's one of the, I don't know if I told you this story. One of the, I know we're coming up a little on time. When I joined Quizlet, I think it was a top 100 website at the time, or after within a year or two of when I joined. But there were like two full-time engineers. It was PHP, custom stack. The creator had started it when he was 15 and managed it while he was at MIT. So not really like how you would do it in a professional setting, but it worked. And one of the people I hired was a graduate student. He just finished a graduate degree from Stanford. So he came in, we were very excited, like, into education, all this stuff. And he looked at the code base. There, guess how many tests there were?
I don't know.
Top 100 website. Zero. Zero. Zero is in zero. Like, all in the founder's brain. And the other early engineers had just, you know, also young, kind of cowboy coding, was all in their head. And so this, you know, Stanford trained engineer, he was like, I don't feel comfortable writing anything unless we have a test suite. And so, he set up Jenkins. You know, we never had Jenkins before. You know, so all these, but you know, real world code is always like, I think people who grow up, or people who learn in school and then open source code, and they get in their first company and they see what the real world is like, it's a little bit shocking, right? Because real world code is supposed to be like one byte away from breaking. Like, you know, real world code is always kind of a mess.
But there's also other stuff that, I mean, the testing landscape is not just, did I write a test for it? But there's also monitoring and error reports and log tracking, and there's all sorts of stuff to, so that even if your customers don't complain, the engineering team can see that, like, oh, these links are broken, and everybody that clicks on it doesn't work, so they can go fix it.
Or permissions. Like, we had a case where the founder drop DB'd the entire database trying to fix one record, but you know, there were no permissions on there. It was just him and a couple other people, and you know, it was like, oops. So we had at the time, there's a company, I think they're still around, called Percona, that do, like, will help you retrieve. There was a backup, but we had like the highest level plan, so like we had 24/7 like call up someone. You know, there's all these, I don't know how much of that is, I think a lot of that is startup-y, you know, that's sort of like consumer startups on the West Coast, where it's a very much fast and loose, as opposed to, you know, other settings. But I mean, anything that could go wrong, I mean, God, I mean, and we, you know, we were right next to all the startups, Dropbox, all these places, like, you hear these security horror stories all over the place. But you know, the companies are still around and people made money, so I guess it's fine.
Well, yeah. You know, you want things to go as best as possible, but there's levels. There's like a website that shares cat pictures, and then there's systems that handle your healthcare system for you. Some are a little bit more important than others. I'm just saying. So, yeah. Anyway,
yeah.
I guess one last question. You said you were on the West Coast for a while. Are you still on the West Coast?
No. Yeah. So I was, I'm just outside of Boston now.
Okay.
I was out in San Francisco, for, I guess, only three, four years.
Okay.
and had my as happens, had my first child and was very far away and came back. So, you know, all the East Coast people I know who've lived out west, the only reason you come back is family. It's not the weather, it's not the food, it's not the job prospects. But I've been primarily on the East Coast most of my life, but I've left it, so I have perspective on it.
And you're in a co-working space. Is that to isolate yourself from the kids, or
yeah, yes, and yes. So I have three little kids. I'm in an apartment, so I can focus just fine. But I don't have a door that closes that is respected.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
This is one of the things I've had to adapt to working remotely. Like, I've been working remotely, I guess, since 2014.
Okay.
And it's certainly I like people, so it's a challenge for me to actually, you know, just not have other people around, even though I like having a deep think. But it was a whole process, especially the first couple of years for me and my wife to learn that all those like interactions out in the world, like when you just like during COVID, I think this happened to couples, when you just like sit there all day with each other, like you don't really have anything to talk about, right? Like just like, oh, something happened, the bus or this and that. Like it is kind of like the spice of life.
Yeah.
So long way of saying co-working space for me is a very worthwhile investment. It's also just easier just to, you know, I come here, I work, and when I'm home, I
could totally see that if I had, especially in an apartment, I have the luxury of having an office with a door. So
yeah,
I can close it off and if I have it cracked open, that means you can interrupt me if you need to, but if it's closed, it means don't.
Yeah. I think it's also context switching. I think, you have to, you know, being self-employed and being working remote, you have to be pretty good and disciplined, but it's just a lot easier to, you know, like, yeah, it's easier to just have a space where like you do the thing in there and you don't have to. Yeah.
Well, let's wrap it up because we're getting long, but thanks so much for talking with me, Will.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. I'm a fan of your earlier episodes on this new podcast, and I like the idea of, you know, exposing the people behind the code a little bit.
Yeah, and in the future, if there's anybody, I'm kind of saying this both to you and to people listening, if there's people that you think are really influential in the Python community or just interesting people that would be fun to talk to, let me know when you think of them. We'll try to get them on the show. All right. Thanks.
Sounds good. All right. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Python People. Let's keep in touch. Head over to pythontest.com/contact to reach out to me, or /newsletter so that I can reach you, or /support if you'd like to, you know, get a course or something.